Coming up on this episode of Disneyland Weekly, prices have gone up again, Pixar Pier gets an opening date,
a new addition to Paint the Night, and we will complete our Grand Circle tour of Disneyland Park. Disneyland Weekly starts now.
This is Disneyland Weekly.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Disneyland Weekly for the week of February 14th, 2018. I'm Teg Bushman.
And I'm Teresa Urban. Thank you for joining us this week. Now let's get to the news.
Your attention, please. The Disneyland Limited, now leaving for a Grand Circle tour of the Magic Kingdom.
As we discussed last week, Disneyland did increase their prices over the weekend. As of Sunday, every level of ticket and annual pass increased in price, except for the value single-day ticket, which remained at $97, and the value one-day park hopper, which actually dropped in price by $10 to now $147. In the peak season, the one-day, one-park ticket rose $11 to $135. Most of the annual passes went up by at least $100 more per year, except the Southern California Select Pass, which only went up $30 a year.
In addition to the price changes, Disneyland Resort spokeswoman Susie Brown said that further changes are coming later this year to the annual pass program. This is in preparation for Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, opening in 2019. One change that they haven't made is the elimination of the monthly payment plan, which a majority of the pass holders use to pay for their passes each month. If you're an annual pass holder, your renewal discount has also gone away.
When broken down into the monthly payments, the annual passes are still a great value. For the highest level of annual pass, the Disney Signature Plus Passport, which has no blackouts and includes parking and Max Pass, the monthly cost is only $83 after the initial down payment of $147. If you would like to purchase tickets at the old price, there are outlets like Parksavers.com that still have the tickets at 2017 pricing.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion online about all these ticket pricings and stuff like that. And I thought that we should take a little bit of time in the news here just to kind of talk about this. I know we talked about it last episode, but I've seen some interesting things. So one of the main reasons that Disney continues to change their pricing raise their pricing is they cite overcrowding. So the only way to make it a more pleasurable experience for people is to increase the prices. And through their tiered pricing with value season and regular season and peak season, it does lend to that. Now, we talked a little bit last week about this, and I thought about it some more this week, too. I think they just need to build more Disney parks and keep the price low. Because at some point, you're going to get to the point where the ticket prices are going to be so expensive that only like the super rich people can go. Right. And I don't think that's what Walt would have wanted. Another thing I saw online was limiting ticket amounts. So this is something that we didn't talk about last week that I was wondering what your opinion was, Teresa, which is basically, let's say Disneyland decided that every day 45,000 people can come into the park.
Yeah, I can see that. But the thing that I find hard is what if you weren't prepared and you didn't buy your tickets ahead of time and you just kind of showed up and you like, I don't know, you're doing a long weekend or whatever, but you traveled to get there. You get to the gate and you can't get in because they've already sold out their tickets.
So I talked about this with James last night and I said, what if there are parks around the world that require you to do this? What if you had to pre-purchase your tickets? There was no same day ticket sales.
I think that would make sense.
Okay.
Or then, you could just have maybe your same day ticket sales be just super high. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But then that doesn't really solve the problem, I guess. because you still will end up going over that 45,000 mark. Because the whole point is that the parks are overcrowded.
You're right.
So another option, so another thing that James brought up was that annual passes, how does that work? So if you cap it at 45 and you have to pre-buy tickets, well, what if you have an annual passport? How do you limit that in a day or whatever? So then my suggestion to that was maybe you also limit the annual passes, because right now they don't have a cap on how many they'll sell.
Oh,
so I'm wondering if maybe you just cap the annual passes. You say every year we're going to have this many available at each tier.
Sure.
And then, you know, they did say in the Orange County Register article that we got some of this information from, that on average, I think Disneyland said that on average an annual pass holder visits like 8 times a year or something like that, which isn't very much.
No.
I don't know if that means 8 days or eight, or if they're like
8 trips, doing consecutive. Like 8 weeks or something. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
So I'm not sure. I don't know. I obviously, this is a complicated situation.
Right.
If it was not complicated, Disney probably would have already come up with a solution. Do you have any creative ideas?
Well, I don't really have any ideas, but I do kind of have a counter argument for people that are maybe a little upset. I mean, it's never fun to have to pay more to go do the things that you like to do, but I'm on Universal's site right now, and a single day park hopper ticket for Universal Studios, it starts at $165 a day.
Which Universal?
This is the one, actually I'm looking.
Hollywood or Orlando?
Hollywood.
Good.
So, so they're pretty comparative, and I believe Orlando is about the same, because that sounds about what I had paid when I went to visit, because we just did it for a day. So it makes me feel a little bit better that Disney's not like crazy, you know, like way crazily expensive, and that they're still not as much as their competitors. But I mean, it still hurts, because I would rather not have to pay lots. And you know, I guess I don't know. It's
So here's a question for you. Even with this price, do you still think it's a good value?
Oh, of course.
How much would make it not a good value? How much is too much? Well, first of all, one thing that I think a lot of people don't talk about is not many people do a one-day, one-park ticket.
No, yeah,
people
no.
do the park hoppers. And in fact, the park hopper dropped in price $10, which is good. And I think the reason they did that is, you know, if it gets busy at Disneyland and people are tired of the crowd, they can go to California Adventure and there's not as many crowds. It's never been as busy as Disneyland.
Right,
and
yeah.
It was built to handle more people.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. For me, looking at the price of the annual pass and breaking it down to $83 a month, I think that's a heck of a deal, because that's less than one day. So as long as you go, you know, the initial down payment is $147, which is the price of a ticket, a park hopper, because they're not going to let you buy an annual pass, make $183 or, you know, whatever it would be payment, and get in for less. So you have to pay for at least the one day that you're going the first day. That's why it's $147 for a down payment. And then $83 a month. I think that's, you know, when you break it down that way, it actually seems like a great deal. I think they could even increase the annual passport price even more. They could probably double it and it would still be a great deal, as long as you were to go multiple times a month. But then you got to think about families. I mean, that's when it adds up. So let's say you and Vern had a couple kids.
Yeah, family of four, we'll say.
Okay, family of four. So the two of you, $83 a month for you and $83 a month for Vern,
mm-hmm.
plus your kids, which I think are also another 80 something dollars. And so, or high 70s if that. That's a lot of money. That's like $350 probably a month, around there.
Right.
That gets expensive.
Well, and I was looking at that too. I was actually looking kind of off topic, but related. They just announced that they are going to be coming out with a Harry Potter themed cruise.
Oh, really?
However, the tickets to be on this
Universal.
Cruise are over $4,000.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah,
so they
Disney
were talking about that
like
too.
That,
they're just like, how on earth is a family? Well, and this is also, you have to fly to Europe to do this because it's on the Thames. So not only do you have $4,000 per person, you also have your plane ticket just to get
like
onto the boat.
$1,500 a person.
Right. So, yeah. So there was a lot of arguments like, how on earth, you know, family of four, $1,600 just to get on this boat. So it's just
Do you think that that's what it's
nuts. But
do you think that that's what these events are catered towards, though, as a family? Or is this more like the one-off? Like the super fans that'll pay anything to go to it.
Right, yeah. Well, and the other thing, too, is supply and demand. You know, it's basic economics. If there's that high of a demand, you have to try and limit the supply, I guess would be a good way of saying it. So like this cruise, this Harry Potter themed cruise, since this is going to be the first go around, of course they're going to have it crazily expensive. Otherwise, everybody would try and be on that boat, you know?
Well, but again, just like we talked about earlier, they only have so many tickets. I mean, if you go to a concert, there's only so many seats in the venue. So when I was talking with James about this, mm-hmm. we talked about Hamilton. Hamilton was extremely popular, mm-hmm. but there's only so many tickets per showing. They still made tons of money, mm-hmm. and it made it like the hottest ticket to get in town. I don't want Disney parks to be like that, though. That's the problem.
No, I don't either. But I mean, I guess that's probably maybe their simplest fix is, you know, if you keep increasing the price, then you're just going to have some people that are going to filter out because whether they don't afford it or they just don't, you know, they can't afford to, or they just don't think it's worth, you know, it's not worth that dollar amount to them to be there. I don't know. It's hard for me to think that way because, I mean, I don't like it because I'd rather not spend that much money up front for the ticket, but I mean, I'll still go. So
yeah, but if you spend less for a ticket, you probably end up spending more on merchandise and food and stuff, right?
Yeah, but okay, think of it this way. Say we're going to be crazy and they drop it down to $50 to get into the park. Everybody would be there all the time.
It's true.
It would just be
packed. Maybe they should lower the admission price and go back to tickets?
Perhaps.
A, B, C, D, E?
Either that or maybe just have different types, you know, different, like, during, I think they need to change up their peak season versus their value, I guess, because they're not calling it off season anymore. Maybe, you know, hike up your peak season because there's already a very, very high demand.
Well, the problem is there's barely any downtime anymore resort. You know, do they need to cut back on offerings to make people, like the holidays, they have tons of offerings. They have holiday parades, they have holiday fireworks, they have all the decorations. If they're worried about crowds, do they just stop doing that?
I don't know if that'd make a difference or not. Because I feel like the only people that are maybe coming back for the, you know, that's kind of more for the annual pass holders, gives them a reason to come back multiple times throughout the year to see different things, experience different things. But I don't know.
I don't know if
I don't know how they're
going
to do it, but I'm sure they'll figure out something.
What do you guys think? Let us know. Twitter, Facebook, feedback at DisneylandWeekly.com. Let us know what you think. Do you have an idea of how you think they could fix this? Let us know.
I mean, personally, I'm just voting for that third park so that it's closer to us.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely want a third park like that, like we talked about last week. All right, moving on. Unlike previous D23 expos held around the world, this year's expo was in Japan and had some information on attractions coming to the U.S. resorts in the future. Disneyland Resort Paris is getting a reimagineered rock and roller coaster theme to Marvel characters. Hong Kong Disneyland is getting a new Marvel attraction as well, replacing their Buzz Lightyear's Astro Blasters. In Disney World, more information was released on the upcoming Guardians of the Galaxy attraction, replacing Ellen's Energy Adventure with a new ride system for the new roller coaster. New concept art for the new Star Wars Hotel, and an opening time frame for Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway that is replacing the Great Movie Ride. That attraction is now scheduled to open in 2019.
So what about Disneyland? Well, not too much. Pixar Pier's opening date was just announced as June 23rd, 2018. It will open with the Incredicoaster, and it wasn't clear if the Inside Out attraction would make it for this opening. Along with Pixar Pier, there will be a new Incredibles themed float coming to Paint the Night Parade that is launching with Pixar Fest on April 13th.
I like the idea. This is something else that I think that Disney's doing pretty well, is I like the idea that they're taking something that already exists, Paint the Night, mm-hmm. and they're adding stuff to it.
Yeah.
Because then it's like
dressing
a new experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that I've had a complaint about for a long time is the Christmas Fantasy Parade has not changed in like forever. You know, instead of spending a ton of money on redoing a whole new parade, why don't you just swap out a float or two every couple years? It keeps it fresh.
Yeah.
I like the idea of doing stuff like that. You don't need to constantly come out with something new. I mean, you know, we're getting Star Wars Land, for instance. We don't need a whole new land. Just, you know, like, give us one attraction every once in a while. Like, we don't need a whole land mm-hmm. to go visit. I mean, I know that's the thing right now, but but I mean, I'm kind of excited. I thought that they were opening Pixar Pier in April, but I guess they did the extra time for June to really launch it with the Incredicoaster and everything.
Yeah, well, so maybe the original date was with Pixar Fest in April, but yeah, it doesn't seem like they're as far along as I would have thought.
No, it's still a lot of construction walls.
Mm-hmm.
Well, last week there was a great story that the Orange County Register ran about one of the Imagineers that worked on Space Mountain taking his final ride. It talks about the design and work that went into the attraction, Bill Watkins, the Imagineer featured, and his life post-Imagineering, and how he was befriended by a 29-year-old Kyle King who made his last ride a reality. The last ride was done with the lights on so Bill could see all the work that went into the attraction. Upon completion, he asked to go again, this time with the lights off. He exclaimed afterwards, "It's better in the dark." That was a terrific article, and I suggest you all read it. You can find the link in our show notes at DisneylandWeekly.com. Teresa, did you have a chance to look at this article?
Nope, I didn't.
There was something I wanted to read here at the end directly from the article because I thought it was great. I kind of summed it up in the thing, but I think it's I think it's better just kind of getting the end thing here. So there's lots of information about Space Mountain in this article, but I'm just going to read the last little bit here. So to honor Watkins, the Space Mountain staff turned on the lights inside the usually dark ride. The lights made it possible for Watkins to examine his old handiwork. He noticed details like the width of the tubing on the track, 2.5 inches, and how quickly the cars launch, once every 22.2 seconds. Watkins and King sat in the first car and zoomed through the ride. He said he remembers working on the math for the highest banks and the fastest curves. When the ride finished, Watkins didn't smile. Someone asked him how he felt. "Fine," the aging engineer said. And then Watkins did what we would all want to do when faced with our last ride. He asked a simple question, "Can we go again?" The staff hopped back into position, but this time they turned off the lights. Watkins said he wanted to ride Space Mountain the same way millions of others had ridden it over the past 41 years. This time, the ride seemed faster. It's better in the dark. Great writing from, if I go back up here, who wrote this article? Keith Sharon wrote this article. So I suggest going and reading this article. I thought it was very well done and very interesting. So.
Oh, no, I like that. That's cool.
Yeah, it's cute. Because you don't think about people that work on these rides for years.
Well, and as we were saying last week, I mean, that ride was back in the 70s mm-hmm. that opened. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, as we talked about previously, breakfast has recently moved to the Red Rose Tavern from Rancho del Zocalo. With this move has also come some new food options. The new items are French-inspired, and they look ambitious. If you are looking for slightly less ambitious, you can now dine at Splitsville in downtown Disney, which has finally opened. So on Mice Chat, they actually did have a photo of the new menu. Looks like there are 6 different items on that. The bottom 3 items on the menu are things that had carried over from Rancho del Zocalo, which also carried over from Riverbell, Mickey-shaped pancakes, mm-hmm. pancakes, and some sort of breakfast platter.
Not named the same things, but they're the same things.
Yeah. But the new stuff looked pretty good. There was some sort of breakfast flatbread pizza. There was also a croquette and the other what was the other one now? Something with a, I don't know, something with a
garden
croissant.
Vegetable hash.
Yes, there we go. Garden vegetable hash. Yep. So I don't know. I think that I'm not a big breakfast person, but they look pretty tasty to me.
Well, they still got the Mickey shaped pancake, so that's good. I also see at the bottom of the menu here, they have Gaston's Famous Brew, which is an apple mango punch topped with passion fruit foam. That could be interesting.
Yum.
Yeah. Well, now through March 16th, you can see an extended sneak preview of Disney's A Wrinkle in Time, along with costumes from the film, at Disney California Adventure's Sunset Showcase Theater.
To celebrate Black History Month, the voices of 17 gospel choirs will present the 9th annual Celebrate Gospel at Disney California Adventure on February 17th on Stage 17 in Hollywoodland from 10 a.m. to 6:30 p.m.
This summer, Rey from the new Star Wars trilogy will be coming to the Star Wars Launch Bay in Tomorrowland as part of the Lightside Meet and Greet.
All right, so we decided we needed to just at least touch on this. So as most of you know, we record the podcast on Tuesdays. So today is Fat Tuesday. So we had to talk about the very nicely done Mardi Gras decorations that were up in New Orleans Square. It just looks like your traditional Mardi. It looks very much like the French Quarter does in New Orleans. But I just think they were really
tastefully
done. Maybe a
little exaggerated.
Well, of course. I don't know. It's Mardi Gras. Everything's exaggerated.
That's true.
But they're very nicely done. They've been up since just after Christmas. And obviously, they're going to be coming back down. But they had nice, all sorts of bright colors and just looks very nice. Well
done. Yep, beads everywhere. Mm-hmm.
Some new creatures debuted over the weekend, too, at Guardians of the Galaxy Mission Breakout. 3 very adorable Vilus have been added to the queue, and they are kind of more than what meets the eye. The creatures do have a little bit of artificial intelligence, so they actually are able to see and react with you. So this is part of the ride queue. I always like interactive ride queue, so I'm glad that they are kind of jazzing this one up a bit, because I feel like there's a lot of potential for this ride.
The Imagineers are holding to what they said. They said with Mission Breakout, they were going to add new surprises from, you know, because it's a collection, so stuff's going to come and go. So it's good to see that they're holding up to that, and that the Bean Counters up in Burbank aren't putting the kibosh on it quite yet.
And there is a very nicely done video on Mice Chat of the interaction that they had with the little cute fuzzy guys.
They were pretty cute. They were pretty cute. I want to see them in person to see the kind of the artificial intelligence and stuff. So, well, Teresa, we finally made it all the way around the park. Unfortunately,
we're back at the beginning.
Main Street will remain open for an additional hour for our shopping convenience, which, you know, what's really interesting? I heard recently that actually it's only open a half an hour now. Which is weird.
Really?
I feel like it's an hour. I think
it takes them 30 minutes to get everybody out of the stores maybe, and through the cash register lines.
Maybe. So this week we're talking about not what else, Disneyland's Main Street USA. We did cover this last because we wanted to start with some more attractions and more kind of excitement. So for those of you just joining us this week, we started in Adventureland. We went through New Orleans Square. We went to Critter Country. We did Fantasyland. Frontierland, then we did Fantasyland, we did Toontown and Tomorrowland together, and this week it is Main Street USA. If you're just joining us, though, do not fret, because next week we will start at Disney's California Adventure, and we will start probably on Buena Vista Street and work our way through the different lands, and we'll talk probably a little bit more about the history than we have necessarily with the Disneyland stuff. We can talk about some old attractions and stuff, because it is still a fairly new park, but there's already quite a bit of history. So what do you have to kick us off, Teresa?
Well, Main Street USA was an opening day attraction, or opening day land, I guess would be a good way to say it. But it was actually inspired by Walt's hometown, which was
Marceline, Missouri.
Yes. And I did find a nice quote by Walt himself, and it's, "For those of us who remember the carefree time it recreates, Main Street will bring back happy memories. For young visitors, it's an adventure in turning back the calendar to the days of their grandfather's youth." I thought that was a really nice summary of really the spirit of Main Street.
Yeah.
So a little kind of, you know, some little history tidbits about Main Street, because Main Street is just packed with history. The bronze partner statue, which is the statue of Walt and Mickey holding hands, was sculpted by Blaine Gibson, was added to the park in 1993. I guess I didn't realize that it was kind of more of a newer addition. And also one thing I thought was really cool was the oldest building in Disneyland is actually on Main Street. It is the Main Street Opera House, which is in the Times Square. It formerly served as the park's lumber mill from 1955 to 1961.
Yep. Yeah, actually, the Opera House was not an opening day attraction. I mean, it was just a building that was still there. You know, good use of that. One thing before I forget, that's kind of interesting. It's a little unique to Main Street. Main Street, we almost missed Tomorrowland last week when we were talking about the dedication plaques. And the dedication plaque for Main Street is actually the dedication for Disneyland.
Mm.
So the dedication reads,
"To all who come to this happy place, welcome. Disneyland is your land. Here age relives fond memories of the past. And here youth may savor the challenge and promise of the future. Disneyland is dedicated to the ideals, the dreams, and the hard facts that have created America, with the hope that it will be a source of joy and inspiration to all the world."
And I have to say, I think it is a source of joy and inspiration to all the world. I think all of you listening probably feel this way. I know countless people that have visited Disneyland probably agree and feel this way. So it's awesome. Mm-hmm. Now, you were talking about the partner statue. Mm-hmm. So I have a story. We'll see if I tear up, because I always feel like very kind of teary when I talk about this. So I went on a Walk in Walt's Footsteps tour at Disneyland a few years ago. And one of the things towards the end of the tour was we stopped in Town Square, in the hub where the partner statue is. And the artist who developed it said, you know, like, you know, kind of explain like what is it or whatever, what is going on there.
Sure.
So for those of you who may not remember or have never been there and haven't seen it, it's, you know, Walt's holding Mickey's hand and Walt's kind of pointing off and Mickey's kind of standing there.
I always felt that they were pointing at the castle.
but they're not. They're pointing down Main Street.
Oh, you're right.
So
they're facing the other way.
What Walt is saying to Mickey, and oh god, this just gets me. he's telling Mickey, look what we created together, which I think is awesome because it's like. You know, Walt is always, you know, Walt always said at the, during the Disneyland TV show, you know, I hope we never lose sight of one thing, and that's that it all started with a mouse. Mm-hmm. So putting Walt with Mickey in the middle of the park and showing that what they created together, it's kind of a cool, cause it's kind of like, I mean, Walt Disney had kids, but Mickey's kind of like his first kid,
for
you know?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a sentimental kind of thing, and it was just kind of like, oh my god, if I ever had to be a tour guide and say that every day, I'd be so teary. Because I don't know, just something's really powerful about that to me for some reason.
I agree.
Where do you want to start on Main Street?
Oh, one more cool thing about just Main Street in general.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew this, but there is an actual real part of history located in the town square. The cannons that are displayed in the center of the square were actually used by the French army in the 1800s. However, they were never fired in battle. And the gas lamps that line the streets were actually from Baltimore and purchased for 3 cents per pound.
Yep. Yeah. And what's interesting about Main Street that people don't really think about is, you know, it's kind of to show, it's kind of this weird area in American history where we've gone from the gas lamp to the electric bulbs. We went from a horse-drawn carriage to, you know, gas-powered vehicles. Mm-hmm. And Main Street has it all. I mean, the lamps down Main Street are all gas.
Yep.
But all of the front facades of all the stuff are electric.
Mm-hmm.
You can ride the horse-drawn carriage.
Or the automobile.
So it's really interesting that all of this kind of ties up together. So let's start, let's see. Well, let's do it like we're leaving the park. So is there anything in the hub area that you had listed that you wanted to see, or should we start heading down the street?
Let's just start heading down the street.
All right. So as we head down the street, some of the things that we'll come in contact with are the Main Street vehicles. Let's start there. So there's quite a few Main Street vehicles. There's the omnibus, which I really love, which is the double-decker bus. I love riding that because I like getting on the top and being able to see things from a specific kind of view there. The other thing that you can get there is you get, of course, the fire truck that you can ride.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also, why am I blanking on what else?
Horse-drawn streetcars.
Horse-drawn streetcars, which, you know, with the horses and everything.
Mm-hmm. And like we said, an automobile.
Yep. So, and that's the horseless carriage.
Yes.
Is titled double decker bus, fire engine, and automobile. So that's all the regular vehicles that go mm-hmm. up and down. Do you have any interesting tidbits about any of those?
So apparently Walt was fairly fond of the fire engine, and he used to actually drive the fire engine around the park before the park would open.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I can see that.
Interesting.
Yeah,
especially
I can see
especially since his apartment was above the firehouse.
Right. Yep. So there's a famous. I'm trying to find it right now because I wanted to remember exactly what the picture was. But the last, yes, here it is. The last picture of Walt Disney taken at Disneyland is Walt Disney in the fire truck mm-hmm. with Mickey Mouse in front of the castle.
Wow.
So it was his favorite, and it was the last time he had a picture taken at Disneyland.
Wow. Very cool.
Yeah. So we got those. As we go down, another common sight on Main Street is the Dapper Dans. And the Dapper Dans is the barbershop quartet. Of course, you can't have a Main Street turn of the century without a barbershop quartet. For a long time, it was my understanding that the Dapper Dans were a group of four guys that had done it for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big hoopla. I want to say five to 10 years ago when they told everybody that had a position on stage that every 2 years, I believe it is, they have to re-audition for the position. And now they have a whole new Dapper Dan thing. And the same thing happened with the Disneyland band that plays on Main Street. So what do you have for Dapper Dans?
Well, the Dapper Dans have been performing at Disneyland since 1959. The Dans can often be seen in Disneyland on their Schwinn custom four-seater bicycle that was commissioned by Mr. Walt Disney himself.
I've never seen that.
I haven't either. I've seen photos of it, but I've never mm-hmm. seen it, like, you know,
it's probably too packed now.
Could be. And then actually, the group performs as a quartet. However, there are actually up to 12 singers at each park.
Oh, wow.
So I know. Just... I was surprised. So, and it kind of said that they did this because, you know, so they can have different performances going on throughout the park. I guess I've never noticed that they have the Dapper Dans performing in multiple places, but they, you know, sometimes have them in parades and,
oh, yeah,
you know, extra stuff. So I guess it's kind of, you know, you don't want those poor Dans to be,
well, and they're not going to be
singing in the park all day and then, yeah, doing the parades and stuff at night too.
I usually see the Dapper Dans at opening because you're coming in down Main Street, and
they do perform throughout the day.
Yeah, and you see them, and they move around and everything. So, I like it. I like them. They're cool. I like barbershop quartets.
I have terrible timing and never seem to be able to run into them. I need to like figure out their schedule and stalk them. Apparently,
well, around Halloween time when they do Mickey's Halloween party, they put the Dapper Dans on the Rivers of America.
I know, I've seen a video of that, and I just love that they do music from a haunted mansion. That's just, ugh.
Right?
So cool.
Yeah, yeah. Dapper Dans, awesome. So as we go down, okay, something that goes up and down the thing, and it's actually part of history, but we would be amiss to not talk about it, was the Main Street Electrical Parade.
Oh, I love the Main Street Electrical Parade.
So, the Main Street Electrical Parade, Teresa, you probably have a bunch of information on this, but...
Tons.
So, the opening date was June 17...
Original.
The original opening date was June 17, 1972. And what else you got?
So there were two runs. So the original opening date, like Tag just said, is June 17th, 1972. And it ran until November 25th, 1996. They took a few years off, and then it returned to Main Street January 20th, 2017 through August 20th, 2017. So just a short run here this past year. But I guess I didn't realize this, that it was actually hosted in California Adventure from 2001 to 2010. I guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah, California Adventure opened, was not popular at all. They thought, what could bring a bunch of people back?
Bring them over.
They couldn't bring the Main Street Electrical Parade back to Disneyland because they made such a hoopla that it was glowing away forever in 96 to make way for their new show.
Was that Paint the Night?
No. Paint the Night is much newer. I'm trying to find it right here. Light Magic, which lasted one season. Everybody hated it. And people, you know, it's just never been around. They never really had another nighttime parade until they brought Paint the Night, which is great. And then, of course, the Main Street Electrical Parade has been everywhere. There was a period of time, I believe, right after it was... So on June 14th, 1997, so after the end of its run, they ran it in on Broadway in New York for the opening of Disney's New Amsterdam Theater and the film Hercules. So it ran in New York. And then for a while, it was in Walt Disney World.
Yep. And that's where I saw it.
Yep. And then it got shipped back to California Adventure. And then it's kind of hung out and been everywhere. Now, one of the sad things about the Main Street Electrical Parade to some people is that one of the floats actually was destroyed in coming back from Disney World. And so a good chunk of the parade float that dealt with the circus for Pinocchio never made it back to the return this last summer.
Well, yeah, it looks like I'm seeing here that it was in the Magic Kingdom for also, it looks like three separate runs there. So it kind of went back and forth and back and forth. So I'm surprised that only one float was damaged through that. Because how do you ship those? But
well, the Magic Kingdom had its own version of the electrical parade that started in 1977, but ended in 99. And I think they destroyed those because it was the nighttime parade was replaced by Spectro Magic in the Magic Kingdom. And then in Tokyo Disneyland, they have an electrical parade called Dream Lights, which is somewhat similar. So, yeah, the electrical parade has quite a history. Everybody knows the music. The music is even sort of in the background of Paint the Night now, which is great. People, you know, in the beginning, I believe, is also like that for Paint the Night. It's very, you know, ladies and gentlemen kind of thing. So everybody loves the electrical parade. I'm glad that it came back for a while. I'll tell you what, though. There was a summer that I went there, and I think I saw the thing like five times in the course of like a little period, and I was like, I'm kind of done with the electrical parade. But it is a piece of history, and there was nothing else quite like it.
Mm-hmm. So the first rehearsal for it was actually quite a disaster.
Was
it? A float actually crashed into a building on Main Street, USA, and some of the performers' costumes actually were emitting sparks. But despite those obstacles, they did successfully debut on the scheduled date of June 17th. And let's see, the original parade floats featured the Blue Fairy, a large drum pulled by Casey Jr. and Jin, Cinderella, a Chinese dragon, and the Circus Calliope. And I guess I didn't realize that the inspiration for the Main Street Electrical Parade was the Disney World Electrical Water Pageant. I actually haven't seen that.
I've seen video.
I've seen video. I haven't seen it in person.
It's very 2D Christmas lights.
It is. It's very 2D, and I guess they're kind of similar, but it seems to me like the Electrical Water Pageant isn't as grand as the Main Street Electrical Parade was.
Yeah, I agree.
I also thought that this was interesting, too. So 2 months to the deadline, Disney actually discovered that their contractor was crazily far behind schedule, and they actually decided to finish the floats themselves in a backstage area at the park. Disney brought on welders, electricians, and other temporary workers just to assemble the floats, and they actually had to hand tint and installed 500,000 light bulbs.
Wow.
Let's see. And then they also talked about that the engineers that helped create the parade also created the first automated parade show control program, and so this is how the parade routes contain multiple radio active trigger zones, and so you're hearing the correct,
like all modern parades.
Yep, exactly. So now that's when you hear the correct music for the float that's in front of you instead of, you know, having a lag.
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, Disney, technological, man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so moving on, the Main Street Cinema. What do you got for that? Anything?
So that was an opening day attraction, so July 17th, 1955. It just kind of continuously plays Disney shorts, and there's six different screens, but it is always playing the original 1928 cartoon classic of Steamboat Willie.
Of course. A good thing, a lot of people walk by this and don't really realize what it is,
yeah,
but I'll
I'm
tell
kind
you
of
what.
The one that walks by.
If you go in there, there's hardly anybody ever in there, but if you need air conditioning, seriously,
oh,
you
I
go
believe
in.
It.
And to be honest, I am surprised that Disney, along especially during the Paul Pressler eras of the late 90s, did not condemn this, but like take this area over and turn it into a store, because it literally makes no money. It's just this little
just
area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, they've upgraded it fairly recently. I think it's got digital projection now for the stuff, and again, great for air conditioning. Did you have anything about the Disneyland band?
Not much. Just that they've been part of the park since opening day.
Perfect. I love the Disneyland band. I liked it when, if you get there before the gates open, like the band will come out and play and everything.
A little bit of extra entertainment for you.
And you can
there
find
waiting.
Them sometimes on the Mark Twain, like they'll go play their stuff. I mean, they go everywhere, but they're mainly Disneyland. All right, so moving on, we've got the Disneyland story presenting great moments with Mr. Lincoln. Of course, Mr. Lincoln is awesome. Because this was the first humanoid audio animatronic, isn't it? And it came from the World's Fair, 1964-65?
Yes. So, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln opened in Disneyland on July 18th, 1975. So, it was originally showcased at the 1964 New York's World's Fair. But this actually ran from April 22nd, 1964 to October 17th, 1965. So, I don't know if you're paying attention out there, but Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln actually opened in the park before the World's Fair was over.
Huh.
So I didn't know this.
Me either.
But it's actually a duplicate show. This is
really?
not the original audio animatronic that was at the World's Fair.
I did not know
that. I didn't know that. For the longest time, I thought that this was like, it's a small world. I thought they just brought the attraction to the park.
Yeah.
But no, they actually duplicated the attraction.
Huh.
It was actually kind of interesting to me. So the original World's Fair audio animatronic Lincoln was actually believed to have been lost.
Oh.
Many years later, they actually discovered that it had been placed in a crate and packed away shipped back to California, and somehow mysteriously was forgotten for decades. But the original audio animatronic is actually currently on display at Walt Disney One Man's Dream Attraction at the Hollywood Studios in Walt Disney World.
Which is now Walt Disney Presents.
Oh, okay. Well, yes.
It's okay. Now, I'll tell you, there was a version of this attraction that I did not like.
I didn't realize that they had so many different versions of this.
Yeah, so they've had a number of different versions. The one I did not like was, I believe it was right before, it had to have been this version here. I'm trying to look at the years reopened. Yeah, so the Walt Disney Story featuring Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, The Journey to Gettysburg. I didn't like this one. It was interesting that they tried to do some interesting things with technology. Part of it was you wore headphones, and it was like a guy was like talking in your ear and like giving you a haircut, so it sounded like your hair getting cut like right in your ear. And so it was interesting because it was like trying to like bring you into it. I just didn't think it worked. So that opened in July 17th, 2001. And closed when on February 20th, 2005, to make room for Disneyland the First 50 Magical Years, which was the film presented by Steve Martin and Donald Duck for the 50th anniversary, which I loved. Mm-hmm. Did you know that Steve Martin worked at the Magic Shop on Main Street?
I did know that. Yeah. I don't remember why I know that, but yes, I did hear that.
So back on, then on December 18th, 2009, it returned in its current form, which I think is great. What else you got for Lincoln? Nothing?
So Walt's original idea for the show was to pay tribute to actually all of the U.S. presidents, and this was part of a proposed expansion of Main Street back in the late 1950s.
Yeah, they wanted to expand halfway down Center Street, is what that's called. They wanted to do, I don't remember, Liberty Square or something? Or not Liberty Square, but they called it something.
Yeah, I don't remember what it was called. Sure. But unfortunately, that idea got scrapped because the technology at this time did not allow for a show on the scale that Walt had originally wanted. So the Main Street expansion was abandoned. So Imagineers opted instead to focus on creating a tribute to Abraham Lincoln, who was Walt Disney's boyhood hero.
Eventually, Walt Disney's dream of having a bunch of all of the presidents came to fruition in the Magic Kingdom in Liberty Square. And by the way, it was Liberty Street that they were going to do. So when they were designing Magic Kingdom, they decided to put the Hall of Presidents and Liberty Square in Magic Kingdom. So that's pretty cool. Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln is also one of those attractions that I think is kind of like the Tiki Room, where I think people would throw a fit if they got rid of it.
Yeah, I think so too. However, I shouldn't be disappointed, but I am a little disappointed because I thought that this was the same thing from the World's Fair, but it's just...
Yeah, that's interesting.
It was built at the same time. It just isn't the exact same one.
Lies. Lies. Did you have in your notes that the mask was created using a life mask, like a model
did.
Of the life mask?
Yeah, so...
Of actual Abraham Lincoln?
Let me see. Where was that?
You didn't have it in your notes?
No, because I had too many notes.
I was going to say, you have all these notes.
So Lincoln's face was created by sculptor Blaine Gibson, who was the one that did the Partners statue. And he used a copy of a life mask of Lincoln that was made by Leonard Volk in Chicago back in 1860. So that was pretty darn cool. I'm surprised that they actually were able to like access and have this life mask of
Abraham if you think of the Lincoln, time when they would have gotten access to that, it was when Disney had a lot of pull everywhere. People were like, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, they got that skull for pirates.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
All right. So right next door, or kind of in the same building there, is the Disney Gallery. Now, the Disney Gallery, I have fond memories of the Disney Gallery when it was above Pirates of the Caribbean in New Orleans Square. Mm-hmm. But it was moved to Main Street.
On October 2nd, 2009 is when it opened in Main Street.
Yeah, so it's been there. The area used to be the Bank of Main Street and then turned into an annual passport processing center for a while. But now it is the gallery. And actually, have you been in there since 2000? Yeah, you've been in there since 2009. Mm-hmm. It's cool because they use the vault as like a showing room and stuff. And that's always kind of cool because you couldn't really see that before.
So yeah, from 1987 to 2007, the Disney Gallery was located in New Orleans Square. I found this interesting that the gallery is a changing exhibition, and it's focused primarily on artwork from Walt Disney Imagineering created in the designing of Disneyland. So the length of the exhibits range anywhere from 3 months to 10 years.
Oh, wow. What stayed for 10 years?
I don't know.
Wow. I know that one thing that they had for a while that I really enjoyed is you used to be able to do, it was called Disney Print on Demand, and you used to be able to get attraction posters and stuff that way.
Wow.
So you'd go in and you could go through, and whatever you wanted, you'd just tap it on the screen and you hit buy. And then at the end of the night, like, they'd print it while you're out doing whatever, and then you pick it up at the end of the night. So my attraction posters that I have upstairs from Big Thunder and Disneyland Railroad came from that.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I think they still have something of that. I actually think there's also a kiosk that does the same thing in the World of Disney store in Downtown Disney, if I remember correctly. So anything notable other than what we've already said about the gallery?
Nope.
Good. All right. We're moving on. Now, many of you may have thought that this attraction that we're going to cover next should have been covered in three other lands already. But we waited for Main Street because the only proper place to talk about the Disneyland Railroad is on Main Street. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you know this, Teresa, but my favorite building in Disneyland is the Main Street train station.
I did know that.
You did know that.
I did.
I love the Disneyland Main Street Railroad Station. I don't know why. I just love it. I love it. I love it. I built a Lego model out of it. Mm-hmm. Like,
I think that's why I know.
Oh, I loved it. Loved it. Loved it.
Legos.
Ever since the very first drawings of Disneyland, there was always going to be a train. When it was at the park across from their studios, there was a train. When it moved to the famous drawing that got them the loans to build the park back in 1954, it had a train. Almost every Magic Kingdom style park, with the rare exception of Shanghai Disneyland, I believe it was, has a railroad. And railroads are actually pretty popular at a lot of different amusement parks. I mean, even Knott's Berry Farm has a railroad and stuff. So I remember the Disneyland Railroad used to go a lot faster. There used to be a lot more trains, it felt like they'd come quicker.
Sure, yeah.
And I miss the old, I believe it was Thurl Ravenscroft who did the voice of Tony the Tiger, but also did the voice of some of the voices in the Haunted Mansion and some other voices around the park. He did the narration and he sounded like an old train person. And I really kind of miss that. But let's get into some specifics here. So first of all, the locomotives, there are five locomotives that are on the track or can be on the track. Some of them are a lot older than others. The oldest train on the track, it was built in August of 1894. It's the number 3 locomotive, named after Fred Gurley, built by Baldwin Locomotive Works, entered service at Disneyland on March 28th, 1958. The second oldest one is actually locomotive number 5, the Ward Kimball, named after, he was one of Walt Disney's team of animators, known as one of Disney's 9 old men. So he, and in fact, he was born in Minneapolis, so close to kind of where we are, so that's good. It was built in September 1902, also by Baldwin Locomotive Works, and entered service on June 25th, 2005, so right before the 50th anniversary. Going in order after that, we have the car number 4, the Ernest S. Marsh, which was built in April 1925, also by Baldwin Locomotive Works, and entered service on July 25th, 1959. And then there are the two, the number 1 and the number 2, the C.K. Holliday and the E.P. Ripley, and both were built in 1955 by Wed Enterprises, and both entered service on July 17, 1955. The C.K. Holliday was built to resemble Walt Disney's miniature Lilybell locomotive, which had been modeled after the Central Pacific No. 173. Five locomotives. I thought there was only 4, but I guess there's 5, so that's good. Today, the Disneyland Railroad operates 4 sets of train cars as well as a parlor car. It goes all the way around the park. There are 4 stations. There's Main Street USA. There's New Orleans Square, which services New Orleans Square and Critter Country and technically Frontierland. And then there's the Mickey's Toontown Depot, which services Toontown and Fantasyland. And then there's the Tomorrowland Station, which services just Tomorrowland. Which is kind of interesting because you got Tomorrowland Station supposed to be the future and whatever, and it's a steam locomotive.
Yeah.
Now, another thing, as you go around your Grand Circle tour, after you leave Tomorrowland, you go through the Grand Canyon and Primeval World, which were brought over from the 1964-65 World's Fair. Recently, when they did the, when they had the railroad closed for the changing of the back part of the Rivers of America for Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, they added some minor tweaks to these two areas, which, you know, that's kind of interesting. I don't know. My mom absolutely hates going through that section. She goes, it's so annoying. You always go through it. Do you have anything to add about the Disneyland Railroad?
Yes. Yeah, so Walt Disney was the one that kind of came up with the railroad. I guess he always had a fondness for trains. So a young boy, he actually wanted to become a train engineer. When he was a teenager, he actually had a job as a news butcher, which I didn't know what that was until now. But he worked for the Missouri Pacific Railway. So he sold various products to train passengers, newspapers, candies, cigars, that sort of thing. And then many years later, he actually got into polo and had suffered some... What did he do? Oh, he fractured a vertebrae. So he suffered some pretty nasty injuries. And actually, to the advice of his doctor, he was recommended for more calm recreational activities.
Yep.
So starting again in late 1947, he developed an interest in model trains. 1948, his interest evolved into, you know, instead of just small trains, he actually was interested in rideable miniature trains. And so he actually built a backyard railroad. And then it just kind of escalated from there. Then he got the Disneyland Railroad. So I guess I mean, what boy doesn't like trains, I guess, but it's kind of, trains have been a big part of Walt, you know, was a big part of all of Walt's life, not just when he was a boy. So I thought that was interesting.
So a few weeks before the debut of the number 5 locomotive, the railroad, for the first time in its history, hosted a privately owned train on its track. On the morning of May 10th, before Disneyland opened for the day, a private ceremony was held in New Orleans Square Station to honor Disney animator and rail enthusiast Ollie Johnston, supposedly to thank him for helping to inspire Walt Disney's passion for trains, which led to the creation of Disneyland. The true motive for having Johnston there was soon revealed when a simple steam train, not part of the Disneyland Railroad's rolling stock, consisting of a locomotive named Marie E. and a caboose, rolled toward the station and stopped at its platform. Johnston, a previous owner of the steam train, used to run it on his vacation property, which he sold along with the train in 1993. The man who now owned the train was Pixar film director John Lasseter, who had brought the train to Disneyland in order to give Johnston, his mentor, an opportunity to reunite with and drive his former locomotive. Johnston, then in his 90s, was helped into the Marie E., and with Lasseter at his side, he grasped the locomotive throttle and drove his former possession 3 times around the main line.
Wow.
Although Johnston died in 2008, Lasseter continues to run the Marie E., the caboose, and an assortment of train cars on his private Justic Creek Railway, which is complemented by the depot building and water tower from Ward Kimball's former Grizzly Flats Railroad.
Very neat.
I love railroads. There was a... You know the... By where we live in the Wisconsin Dells, there's a small gauge railroad that you can go, and we actually rode that in August.
Oh.
Yeah, it was fun. Is there anything else on Main Street that we did not talk about, or that you would like to talk about, or that we missed?
Nothing else that I can think of.
Every Magic Kingdom park has a Main Street.
Yes, yes.
except for...
No, I think they all have it.
Nope, Shanghai Disney does not. It has Mickey Avenue.
Oh.
And it's not quite a whole thing.
Close, but no cigar.
Close. But, you know, they always have to be like that, right? They have to come up with something new and different or whatever. So,
Well, it gives you a reason to go to each park. So they can't all be exactly cookie cutter.
Yeah, I agree.
The same. You got to
switch
it up.
I've been to 3 Disney parks that are Magic Kingdom style. So I've been to Disneyland Paris, I've been to Disneyland, and I've been to Magic Kingdom. And of all of those... Disneyland is my favorite Main Street. My favorite castle is Disneyland Paris. My least favorite castle is Magic Kingdom and Tokyo Disneyland because they're the same castle. And I think it's ugly. But I don't... I don't, you know, there's something quaint about the Disneyland Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
So something, I forgot to mention this. So something interesting that Main Street uses, and of course the park uses as a whole, is forced perspective. So next time you're at Disneyland, think about this, Teresa. I don't know if you've ever noticed this. If you stand at the train station and look down at the castle, it feels very far away.
Yep.
But if you stand at the partner statue and look towards the train station, it seems very close.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons... I read somewhere one time that they did this was they wanted, Walt wanted to have the excitement and anticipation of like getting down to the castle, you know, and there's, but at the end of the night, you're tired. You just want to go home. So it made the train station look closer. So you're like, oh, we're almost out of here. Well, that concludes our tour of Disneyland. Like I said, next week we will talk about Disney California Adventure. We might talk about the Esplanade a little bit. For those of you who don't know, the Esplanade is the area between the two parks where the ticket booths are. Let's get to some feedback.
We would like to take some time to read some great reviews that we received from iTunes this week. First is from The Pulverizer, who said, "Informative must have. I listen every week to keep updated on the current events in the park. As a pass holder for as long as I was able to have one, 30 plus years, I have a somewhat invested interest in the park and its changes. Other podcasts about the park are a little overstuffed with too many annoying hosts or useless chatter. I enjoy the news, insights, and tidbits brought by Tag and Teresa. They are great to listen to as they don't digress into useless banter and keep on topic. These two actually know what they're talking about and eliminate my need to hunt down information every time I walk into the park and see something shut down. My only gripe is they live too far away and my chances of running into them to tell them in person that they're awesome are slim to none." Well, thank you, Paul. Pulverizer. I'm going to assume that your name's Paul. That's a great review. I'm so glad that you enjoy listening to us. I'm going to be honest, though. Tag and I were both a little surprised that you didn't think that we get off topic, because sometimes we feel like we get a little off topic, but as long as you're enjoying it, that's all that matters. So thank you.
I have to say, almost every episode when we're done recording, Teresa goes, "You didn't think it was going to be a long episode." And I don't, we just kept talking a couple weeks ago, or was it last week when we did the Tomorrowland episode?
Last week when we were supposed to have a short episode that ended up longer. Yeah.
Teresa timed it. It was like, "You know, you spent so and so time on the monorail alone." I'm like, "Oh, geez."
Well, thank you, Paul. We appreciate you.
Yes, yes, yes. So we received another review from Ahoy Maddie saying, "Makes me grin. Knowledgeable and well-researched, this duo brings me back to many aha moments and memories of pure delight. Thanks for being so thorough and objective." Well, thank you, Maddie, or Matt. I love your name. I like pirates, so Ahoy Maddie is kind of fun. Thanks for leaving that review. We really appreciate all this feedback that you guys give us all the time. You know, it really motivates us to keep going. And I'll tell you, people have been, in the last couple of weeks, people have been very chatty with us on Twitter and through the iTunes reviews and everything. And we really
love it.
We really appreciate it. If you've never started a podcast before, which I'm guessing most of you have not, in the very beginning, it's kind of weird because it's kind of like you're talking into the void and you're not sure if anybody's going to be listening. You know, we've got numbers that we can look at for downloads and stuff like that. But you never know really what that is or what people are thinking about it. So feedback is really vital for us to sit here every week and do stuff. And every week, Teresa can attest, this week I set up a dedicated area to sit and do to do our podcasting with, like, you know, a nice monitor and stuff to look at and everything. Because of the patrons, we were able to get a third microphone so we can have a guest on. We're working on trying to actually get our first guest on the show, because there's a... I won't spoil it, but there's a potential to get somebody interesting that has a unique look at Disneyland and something special that they may be doing at Disneyland. So that could be pretty cool. As we wrap up this week, we want to thank all of you for listening in each and every week. Please don't forget to support the show if you can by going to DisneylandWeekly.com/support or by sharing Disneyland Weekly on social media or by word of mouth with other Disneyland fans that you know. This week, we'd like to highlight a new way to support the show. We've added a donate button on our website at DisneylandWeekly.com on the left-hand side. You can click on that and donate through PayPal, a one-time donation, or you can make it recurring if you want. We thought that adding another way to support the show rather than a subscription would be the one-time donation option. So if you're inclined, please go and check that out.
That is all we have for you this week. You can help the show by leaving a review on iTunes, by letting us know how we are doing, good or bad, just like The Pulverizer and Ahoy Maddie did. If you want to keep up with the show, you can follow us on Facebook by searching for Disneyland Weekly, on Twitter at DL Weekly, or sending us an email at feedback@DisneylandWeekly.com. Feel free to email, Facebook, or tweet us any questions, feedback, or suggestions that you may have about the show.
We'll be back next week with more Disneyland news and information.
So until then, go out and enjoy the parks.
Ladies and gentlemen, Disneyland has now ended its normal operating day. We hope you've enjoyed your visit to the Magic Kingdom and that you'll be back with us again soon.